Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment. Once again, this is your navigator, John Lash, recording on the 16th of June, 2013, Nav Briefing 71, The Beauty of Persephone. Well, you know, one of the practices, the main practices in this experiment of ours is to follow the surges, as we call them, the lunar apogee and lunar perigee moments throughout the month, which are located roughly, but not exactly, 2 weeks apart. As you all know by now, who've been proceeding with this little exercise, these moments carry a particular intensity when you are receptive to them. And when you bring a sober mood of anticipation to them. Sometimes, though, they can just catch up on you without knowing it. You know, I have to say that a week ago on Sunday, the 9th, I didn't realize that we were undergoing the massive apogee moment when the apogee stalls in 2 degrees of the sign Cancer at the feet of the twins. We're in a stall now. We went into it last month, as you know. And the stall point is highly significant, to say the least. A while back, I dedicated a talk to the theme of the Gnostic moment. Indeed, this theme and this stall signal to us in the GNE that we stand, all of humanity stands before the Gnostic moment right now. The Gnostic moment, what is the Gnostic moment? We're in it. And those of us in Planetary Tantra, those of you in Planetary Tantra and the GNE who have the intel, who know the story, and who follow the process, have the descriptive syntax to stand consciously in this moment, to live it and to enlive it, E-N-L-I-V-E. We talk about enlivening something. To enliven something is to enlive it. And I rely on you to stand with me steady, steady as she goes through this stall. The stall is signified, of course, by the temporary suspension of the normal advance of the lunar apogee forward through the zodiac. The point of the stall, the locale, the locus, is right at the feet of the twins between their twinkly toes. And the cosmological and astronomical intel on that point is extremely fascinating. We look at that point because there is the location currently of the perihelion of the planet Saturn. That is to say, the point on the elliptical orbit of Saturn, which is closest to the Sun. And as I described regarding my encounter with Vili Sukar, the anthroposophical teacher of astrology that I met in the 1970s in Los Angeles, I received the indication at that time that the apsides of Saturn, both the perihelion point and the aphelion point opposite, which is at the in the bow of the archer, in the hand, at the hand that holds the bow of the archer, that both of these points, which locate the apsides of Saturn, are related to the Gnostic movement or the Magian order or the Gnostic impulse, whatever you want to call it. And that would be then the very spirit of Gnosticism and the Sophianic vision story and the very mission of the Telestai, the mystery teachers, as it evolves and develops through centuries of time. All that would be indicated by this position. So this Gnostic moment is our moment, my friends, my mates, my allies. And I want to emphasize again that regardless of what happens in the world as a reflection or result of Sophia's correction, this is the moment to look at ourselves and to make intramural reflections regarding how we hold the privilege that we have. I can tell you that if you recognize the Gnostic vision story and the specific and incomparable significance of that story and all that goes with it in planetary tantra, then you hold a privilege that very few human animals can claim. And that also is, if I may say so, a very great fact. You know, I have to laugh now every time I use this term, a very great fact, which was the title of the talk posted a week ago at the moment of this apogee surge. I got a lovely note. I get lovely complimentary notes, notes of recognition and appreciation every day from different people. Some of you I already know. Some come completely out of the blue from strangers. And I got a little note saying that someone listening to my briefings has occasion to laugh at the deadly seriousness of my delivery. And I have to say, I laugh at it too. I really do. And I'm going to watch my deadly seriousness a little bit in the next few months, because I don't want to give the wrong impression or be heavy-handed or be spooky about anything. At the same time, I am dealing with some rather serious matters. Nonetheless, it's possible to handle the serious in a light-hearted way, and I seek to do so whenever I can. So in that vein, I'd like to offer my imitation of a cashier at Pizza Hut at Kennedy International Airport. Well, thank you very much for coming to Pizza Hut. Your order is, let's see here. Yes, a pepperoni pizza with triple cheese. You want the deep pan variety, and you want two super size Slurpees. And it is a very great fact that John Lash is the only one who restored the 9-episode version of the sacred narrative. And for dessert, you would have the permacrust 40-ounce Pop-Tart straight out of the oven. That would be $59.95. Thank you. This process, this experiment, is so wonderful for so many reasons. And one of them is the element of suspense and the element of surprise. And I'm surprised that the briefing number 70 on a very great fact came out under the apogee moment, which is not something that I timed and not something that I planned. In fact, the moment completely slipped by me. I was preoccupied. My mind was occupied elsewhere. My first and second attentions were combined at that moment to hold on to a particular piece of intel that came in at the exact moment of the change from the shift of Kumatsu into the shift of Idris, formerly called Bagalamukhi. And that would have been on Saturday, you know, the 8th at 8 p.m. Greenwich time. There was a new moon exactly between the horns of the bull, not at the tip, but rather back toward the forehead of the bull. And it was followed on the 9th by the lunar apogee moment in 2 degrees of Cancer. And during that event, Jupiter had reached 27 degrees of Gemini. That is to say, it was leaping through the horns of the bull. And at 27, 28, Gemini, it was conjunct the Crab Nebula. So all in all, this was quite an event. The dramatic and spectacular end of the Komatsu shift, Fate and Fortune Lead the Dance, into the Idris shift, when you get to see some of the subtle and inconceivably intricate and mysterious workings of fate guided by the instruction of Idris. I have to say that sometime at the moment of the shift, I think on Saturday evening it may have been, I got a piece of Dakini intel that just blew my socks off totally. You know, I've said before that your capacity to detect Dakini intel, that is to say, the subliminal workings of your own mind, by which your mind displays its spontaneous self-liberating power, as well as its spectacular telluric wisdom, the telluric wisdom of the fairies, of the Dakinis, that intel operates at a very, very high velocity. It's a velocity of thought that you cannot normally access. But you acquire the ability to access it by observing the lunar Shaktis. And year by year, you sharpen that ability. So I've been sharpening it for over 40 years. And so naturally I can pick up signals that other people might not be able to detect. And I've often said that the Dakini instruction begins exactly and immediately in the moments after the new moon that signals the completion of the previous shift. So this is the way I was on Saturday evening of June 8th, and I was sitting around here in my usual innocent and charming fashion, being delightful. And pow, I received in Dakini instruction from Idris something like I've never gotten before. So much so that I can say, without intent to alarm you, or either by inference or suggestion, insinuate any kind of paranoia into your mind, but I can say that it was an extremely dangerous piece of intel. Because the content of this intel is such that if I were to put it out directly today, I would be finished within the blink of an eye. I already have quite a bit of intel like that, by the way, in case you were wondering. But this tops it. This takes the cake. This is the cherry on the cake that it takes. Have I got your interest? Of course I can't tell you what it is, because this is a public medium and anybody could be listening. But I can tell you that it has to do with a subject that troubles us all. And so I am happy to assure you that the solution to a very troubling question in Planetary Tantra is now given. What is that question? It is the question of if and how the Archons were able to have access to human genetics. Now, you know, up until now, I have denied that they have tinkered with the genome and therefore manipulated us into being a slave species. That particular scenario, which derives from Zechariah Sitchin and has been picked up by David Icke and, what was his name, Michael Tellinger, who wrote the book Slave Species, is widely, widely discussed and widely, widely accepted by millions of people. This is very serious disinfo. So let me clarify what I can at this point without disclosing what I cannot at this moment disclose regarding this intel. The Archons have never had and will never be able to hack into the human genome at the level of the calibration of the genome by Thelete and Sophia. Period. That's a given. But I don't ask you to take it on faith, my friends. Just consider it this way. This is what John Lash thinks. This is his educated opinion. And if someone can prove that it is not so, let them do so. However, as a result of certain delicate conversations that I had with Pachamama Medicine Woman regarding events that transpired in this kalpa between 14 and 18,000 years ago, and as a result of reflecting on those events, so that my mind was receptive to further instruction, that is to say, that it would enlighten itself upon those events, I was present at the moment that this Dakini instruction was released within the very first hours of the Idris shift. And I downloaded this instruction. And according to this instruction, you must distinguish rigorously between two kinds of codes which determine the morphology and psychology of the human creature. That is to say, two kinds of codes which determine the way you look, the color of your hair, the color of your eyes, the formation of your hands, the formation of the bodily organs of all human animals, following the model of the pentagramic creature, the five-limbed creature, and the behavioral and psychological and emotional and intellectual properties inherent to that model. When you consider that model, which was designed by Thelete and Sophia, consider that the model is, to use an archontic analogy, running on two kinds of codes. The source code, which is DNA, and the selection code, which is RNA. It's all you need to know. There's a source code and a selection code. Okay? And these two codes interact. And one of the great discoveries of the end of the 20th century was the discovery of the function of reverse transcriptase. This led to a whole new paradigm of biology, which is called epigenesis. And you can go and investigate this. And I would consider that it would be one worthy study for crew members when you're below deck in your cabin. Go investigate Bruce Lipton. Go investigate the biology of transcendence, Joseph Chilton Pierce. And go investigate what is epigenesis and reverse transcriptase, which is a chemical that allows RNA, the messenger enzyme of nucleic acid, to rewrite DNA. So you've got this clear picture in your mind. You know, everything about the human animal in this experiment and all the designs and purposes of this experiment from the viewpoint of the divine Sophia herself are accessible to the Anthropos in a simple and direct way. It's really not complicated. It's been complicated and confused by people who don't understand it or who wish to deliberately obscure the truth. So what I can tell you now, in anticipation of further disclosure, is that the Dakini instruction of June 8th, 2013, related to my conversation about his stones with Pachamama medicine woman, showed me that the Archons have not hacked into the human genome at the level of the nucleic genetic program in the DNA, nor have they hacked into the RNA, but they inverted a shunt in the DNA-RNA connection. A shunting device. And the result of a shunting device is that it both blocks the natural flow that would operate between two systems, in this case, the programming DNA and the messenger RNA, and it, at the same time, it deviates that connection, that interaction, and runs it into a blind alley. So the Archons have indeed succeeded in seriously handicapping the Anthropos by inserting this shunt. And what I cannot say now, but I would be happy to say in the near future, when the circumstances are right, is not only how and when they did that, historically speaking, and what is the historical evidence to support it, to support the reality of the event, but how it has played out in history, down to our time, and what we can do about it. So, needless to say, I mean, this is an enormous piece of intel. I've been reeling ever since. So I think I just got off a very great fact to you, in deadly seriousness, around the time that I was fielding this intel, you see. And now it's a week later, and I'm happy to be able to come back to the subject of the beauty of Persephone, as I know that you are dearly and deeply concerned about that particular theme. I'm happy to come around to the moment when I can give to you and share with you my interpretation of that component of the legend of Eros and Psyche. That is indeed a magnificent theme. I've been reflecting on it continually. One of the challenges that I faced before I could come to this briefing on the beauty of Persephone is to set certain limits on the exposition. It's a theme that takes me far, far into the depths of my own understanding, my occult understanding, you could say, or my Gnostic comprehension of events and processes in the realm of the aeons themselves. But I would say, just before I go directly back to the legend, is that these comments I've made so far in the first 23 minutes of this briefing are not irrelevant to what's now to come. As I am going to explain, as I interpret that legend, it is an untold and unprecedented event for an aeon to fall into linear time. Now, the intel that I received from Idris regarding the fate of humanity due to the deepest cut, as it were, to the deepest impact of the Archons. This is the deepest impact of the Archons. And the fate of humanity due to that needs to be understood side by side with an understanding of the nature of time. So let me just take about 5 minutes to frame this up and set this up for you. You know, our mother goddess Kali Ma, who represents the wrath of Gaia and the wrathful warrior aspect of the Aeon Sophia herself, is deeply associated with the mystery of time. I've said this before, haven't I? And the first essential thing that you need to know regarding how Kali relates to time is that Kali, as Durga, the destroyer, destroys the illusion of time. This is often said. You can read it on a thousand different occasions in 1,000 different mythology books and books about the Asian philosophy, Hindu philosophy. But unfortunately, they don't really give you precisely the intel that you need. Kali destroys the illusion of linear time, but she does not destroy time itself. As a matter of fact, by destroying the illusion of linear time, she frees the human mind to enter and explore the mystery of time as a manifestation of the true magic of the generator gods of the aeons. You see, the aeons live in 9 dimensions of time, exclusive of linear time. Human animals live in the illusion of linear time, exclusive of the 9 dimensions where the aeons live. So when Kali destroys the 10th aspect of time, remember, there are 10 powers in the scheme of the Mahavidyas, aren't there? There's Kali herself and the 9 other emanations of time. So there's 10 dimensions of time, one of which is the illusion of linear time. What I was given, I don't want to say that in the passive voice, what Idris transmitted in her first hours of instruction in this shift concerns the way that archons take advantage of human animals due to our being caught in the illusion of linear time. Now, isn't that a fantastic subject? I mean, have you ever heard about that before? Have you ever thought about that before? I haven't. I mean, I'm with you. I'm teaching you what I'm learning. We are in real time together in this experiment. And I'll just give you the specific piece, the specific factor in that intel that I downloaded, which I am able to decode at the moment. The instruction of Idris showed me that the real nature of time that you enter when you pull out of the illusion of linear time is a 9-dimensional fractality of time. 2 dimensions of that 9-dimensional fractality are mirroring dimensions. That means that the moment now mirrors every present and past moment. That means that if you go into the kitchen and make a cup of tea at 9:32 in the morning, and then you sit on the patio at 9:47 drinking the tea, you are both on the patio drinking the tea at 9:47 and making it at 9:32 simultaneously, but you don't see that because you're in the illusion of linear time. And so the first 2 realizations that dawn supernaturally to the human animal, the first 2 dimensions of the 9 dimensions to be revealed, behind the illusion of linear time is the mirroring of the present moment to every past and future moment, the simultaneity of the present moment in past and future. This is an inconceivable mystery that cannot be routed through your NLP as an animal. So do not try to think it through. The Nahual can provide you with a descriptive syntax pointing your attention to the phenomenon, but you cannot conceive or logically interpret this phenomenon. So don't bother to try. The dyad of the ninth and eighth dimensions of the fractality of eternal time in the present moment, you are in the hands of Idris. From that moment, depending on how deeply you wish to go and how much you wish to investigate time and to understand its mysteries, you can descend into the remaining seven dimensions of time. You can enter and penetrate into the remaining seven dimensions of time. And this is one of the paramount experiences of the Nahual that is available to any human animal. And Idris stands at the portal of that exploration of the true fractality and simultaneity of all moments of time. The Archons have an advantage because they have an advantage upon us as we are isolated in the 10th dimension of time, which is the dimension of the illusion of linear time, as I've explained. They have an advantage over us. They take advantage over us. This came in the Idris instruction. Because of a particular frequency that they emanate, the way that a cicada or an insect emanates a constant frequency, it's a white noise in your mind. And this white noise has a measurable frequency, which is detectable to operate on a logarithmic scale. By that I mean that it is stepped down and stepped up in exponential increments of 10. And so they use an actual vibratory frequency that operates on a logarithmic exponential scale. 10, 100,000, 10,000. And that is the frequency they use to hack into the mind of the human animal. And that is also the frequency they used to hack into not the genome itself, but into the RNA-DNA juncture. And then once they had used that frequency to hack into that juncture, they inserted their shunt. And then once they inserted their shunt, it was necessary for them to proceed to another operation, a very elaborate operation, that would allow them to maintain that shunt. So just bear in mind that this is part of an instruction from Idris that I share with you now. And I intend to continue to share this and hold this in the download I received and to decode it as appropriate. And the last thing that you want to bear in mind is that the true operations of time, which are veiled by the illusion of linear time, do not operate according to an exponential frequency based on the number 10. That's why 10 is the illusion of time. That's why Kali is 10. She's 10, or first, but make her 10, in the 10 Mahavidyas, isn't she? And when she breaks the 10, she liberates the human mind into the true fractality and simultaneity of time and the parallelism of past, present, and future. How fantastic is that? The true frequencies of time are given organically. They are given by the lunar cycles, by the solar cycles, and by the cycles of the planetary Earth Mother herself. And those are the only cycles we need to know to live and thrive in this experiment. The archons crack into and block our attunement to those telluric cycles by using the 10-point exponential logarithmic frequency. So with that rather elaborate introduction, at the 35th minute, it's my pleasure to look at, once again, the fourth episode, the fourth task in the Legend of Eros and Psyche to be found in the Latin novel of Apuleius. Reading again from the paraphrase in the book Ariadne's Clue by Anthony Stevens, which I don't recommend. After Psyche achieves her task of her third task of collecting water from the icy waterfall of Styx, which I related to the phenomenon in that unfolded millions and millions of years ago of the formation of the glacial ice caps which control the rhythm of extinctions, Aphrodite poses the fourth and final test. Quote, "With a baleful smile upon her lips, Aphrodite says, 'In truth, I believe you are some great and potent sorceress.'" Well, don't we know that, folks? "So nimbly have you obeyed my hard commands, but you must do me yet this one service, sweetheart. Take this casket and straightway descend to the world below and the ghastly hall of Hades himself. There present the casket to Persephone and say, 'Aphrodite begs of thee to send her a small portion of thy beauty, such at least as may suffice for the space of a brief day. For all her beauty is worn and perished through watching over her sick son, Eros.'" Knowing that she has finished, Psyche goes to a high tower that she might throw herself headlong from it. But the tower informs her that she can accomplish this final task if only she will follow its instructions. She must take with her cakes kneaded in pearl barley and mead to feed Cerberus and 2 coins for the ferryman's toll. On no account must she listen to the entreaties of afflicted souls she encounters on the way, and she must decline the rich feast Persephone will offer her. When she has received the casket containing the beauty ointment Aphrodite has requested, the tower solemnly warns Psyche that she must on no account attempt to open it or try to see what is concealed within. Following this advice, Psyche accomplishes her terrifying mission. But having returned from the underworld, she succumbs to an impulse to steal some of the ointment so as to win once more the grace of her fair lover, Eros. She unclasps the casket, but there was no beauty therein, nor anything at all save a hellish and truly Stygian sleep. Psyche falls to the ground and lies motionless, no better than a sleeping corpse. End quote of this paraphrase. Now, in order to interpret this myth for you, I'm going to break it down first into 2 parts, 2 factors that need to be decoded. The first is the beauty of Persephone itself. So, there is the question, what is the beauty of Persephone? Because Psyche was sent in quest of that beauty. And Psyche did indeed receive a portion of that beauty. She succeeded in her mission. She received a portion. And thirdly, she attempted to take upon herself some of that beauty. So, of course, we want to know what the myth is saying. What is decoded in this syntax, the beauty of Persephone? But there is a second factor which I intend to approach first, and that is the factor of the effects upon psyche of stealing a glimpse at the beauty of Persephone. I'm going to proceed rather in that fashion to first consider the effects. Now, to do so, I'm going to propose to you once again what I initially said regarding the three chapters on this legend to be found in Apuleius' novel. Apuleius' novel in itself is a work of popular literature. Nevertheless, it contains four popular assumptions, a genuine description of an initiation into the rites of the goddess at Eleusis and of the divine Isis, which is one of the many thousands of names for the divine Sophia. I used to use the term Isis Sophia. In fact, I dedicated my first published book, The Seeker's Handbook, which came out in March 1991, to Isis Sophia. At the same time, it appears that Apuleius wanted to transmit to those who were receptive to it some deeper elements of initiation that he had acquired. Probably through discussions and talks with the Teleste of Eleusis. And so I submit that the first three tasks describe episodes in the life of the earth as undergone by the Aeon Sophia in material immanence. That, as you know, is my interpretation of the first three episodes. Also, I submit to you that the first three episodes and the entire legend, in fact, is a recounting in allegorical form, a rare occasion of a retelling in allegorical form of genuine telestic knowledge. And the genuine telestic knowledge encoded in this legend is, or concerns, events that occurred during the Christic intercession. So, that divine entity of great beauty that is called Eros in this legend is equatable to the Aeon Christos. So you could say that in the dreaming of the Aeon Sophia, who finds herself materialized into a planet, the Aeon who comes from the Pleroma to assist her appears as a dream lover. And she cannot view this dream lover directly. She cannot see it directly. It is when she looks at her dream lover, when she unveils her dream lover, and Eros flees, that the whole story pivots, doesn't it? Why would the recognition of Eros change the fate of Psyche? Well, let's recall what the story says. Stay in the story. Observe the story. This is the only narrative in the world, the only narrative on this planet, I assure you, my friends, that has the power to guide your imagination to its true and optimal capacities. Story says that Sophia's exception, that her anomaly, was that she dreamed a planetary experiment unilaterally. So when the Aeon Christos arrived, hey man, hey woman, when that Aeon arrived and showed up in the experiments that she dreamed unilaterally, she was no longer alone, and it was too beautiful to believe, even for her. It was too beautiful to believe, too beautiful to comprehend. And so that is why the allegorical encoding of the story depicts the situation as it does. She must not look at her secret lover. And when she looks at her secret lover, then she faces certain consequences. According to the actual narrative structure of the legend, the first three tasks, which I discussed in a previous briefing, are the consequences of her looking at her secret lover, her dream lover, Eros Christos. But the fourth task is different. The fourth task describes what? The Aeon Sophia, sunken totally in material immanence, must undergo when the Aeon Christos has completed the intercession and the Aeon Christos departs. At that moment, she is once again singular in the unilateral dynamic of her dreaming. This experiment we are in now is a result of a unilateral dreaming. And yet, the Aeons were able to provide to Sophia an assistance, a provisional rescue within her own unilateral dreaming. But in the end of that intercession, she was left again in the same state, determined by the initial conditions which she herself had established by her enthymesis, by the passion she felt for the Anthropos, and by her wish to provide the Anthropos with the best possible environment in which it could correct, in which it could detect and correct its destructive tendencies. So, if you're on the same track as I am here, and if you're taking on the syntax, the narrative syntax, as it's coming to me, comes the moment to see that this legend, this fourth task, encodes something of vital importance to us as the principal subject of Sophia's experiment. Something of vital importance for us to understand regarding what she underwent after the intercession. So I've chosen to talk first about the two effects of her getting a glimpse of Persephone's beauty. And what are those effects? Well, the first one is that she falls into a stupor. In fact, that is really the only effect that's described in the legend. But I propose to you that the stupor that she falls into has two components, which are detectable and verifiable by looking at the earth and looking at the situation of the planetary animal mother over long aeons of time. All right. You heard that. The microphone picked it up. That noise. Three noises, actually. Like something breaking, snapping, or falling. That noise just happened behind me. Nikki is sitting on a shelf with my screenplays and things. It's kind of an alcove of the room. There are some Kerouac books over there. It came from there, and there is absolutely nothing there to explain those noises. Nothing fell, nothing broke, nothing moved. But you heard it right here. So let me proceed. The first factor of the stupor, I would say, is obvious. She fell back into unilateral existence, as it were. without the presence of the other aeon in the earth, on the earth, in the atmosphere of the earth, the aeons of fire plunged once again into the isolation that she endures as the material mother of this planet. And so part of that Stygian stupor is just that. And as I've observed or asserted, is a better word, as I've asserted many times before, one of the first things that came to my attention when I was able to access the planetary animal mother on Infinity Ridge about 9 years ago was the fact that she behaves like an autistic child. And the great challenge in communicating with the Aeons of Fire is to get her attention. And this autism of the planetary animal mother is her stupor. It is her plunge into the Stygian oblivion, if you will. Stygian, referring to the name of one of the rivers in the underworld, a dark river. Stygian is a classical adjective referring to the underworld and to isolation and to darkness. And so, even though her instinctual programs and the synchronization of many of the life programs in the habitat that were burgeoning at that time in the wake of the Cambrian explosion 550 million years ago, even though these matters were put in order by the intercession of the Christos Aeon, Sophia herself was left alone with them. She was left alone with the orchestration that the Aeon Christos established. And it still required, the situation still required, the total occupation of her first attention to maintain and sustain all the planetary activities on this planet, as well as the support of her second attention, which is the source of the planetary experiment in the first place, so you get the picture. But there's a second factor in her stupor. And that relates to my earlier remarks about the staggering intel I received about a week ago. The difference between an aeon and a human animal is not as great as you might think. I have yet to present my lofty exposition on Mayavada Vedanta, have I? Which is purely something of my invention. So don't bother to go find it anywhere. Well, not exactly, but mostly. And were I to do so, I would have to say that there are three principles of Mayavada Vedanta, and the third one is that there is no gradation of consciousness. So as I stand here in my room with my headset on, recording this, and looking out the window at the Andalusian night, or looking over at my cat sleeping in the corner, the awareness that I have of being here and perceiving my world does not differ by any gradient from the awareness of the aeons themselves perceiving it. There is no gradient. There are no hierarchies of consciousness. There is no arduous process of mounting through planes and levels of consciousness into the consciousness of the gods. You have the consciousness of the gods already. You just don't know how to handle it. That's all. But there is one way, one crucial way, in which the consciousness of this human animal, John Lash, and those who are listening to my recorded words right now differs from the consciousness of the generators in the galactic center who are observing all of this. And that is that they do not undergo the illusion of linear time. They operate in 9 dimensions of fractal simultaneity. We operate in the illusion of linear time, the cycles of time, the seasons, the cycle of the day, the 24 hours of the day, the length of a human lifetime, the lunar cycles each month, the solar sunspot cycles, and cycles and cycles upon cycles in linear time. That experience of linear time does not exist for the Pleromic aeons. And so what is the second factor in the stupor of the Aeon Sophia? After the Christic intercession, which is represented by the romance of Eros and Psyche in this charming fable, just because the conditions of the experiment were optimally set up for her by the Aeon Christos, Sophia has the freedom, if you will, the opportunity, the freedom, the latitude to plunge even more deeply into the experiment in which she is immersed inadvertently. Because let's recall what the story says, that she never intended to be herself the setting of the experiment that she dreamed for Anthropos 10. But she is the setting, isn't she? This world around us is not just a stage, like the stage that is created by a group of actors, a troupe of actors who are going to perform A Long Day's Journey Into Night by Eugene O'Neill, or who are going to perform Romeo and Juliet by Shakespeare. In that case, the actors perform their drama on a stage which is inert. But this planet, these forests, these rivers, these oceans, these clouds, this land, the soil under your feet, the breath in your lungs, none of it is a stage. It's not just a stage for human animals to play out their melodramas and their psychodramas. But in order for the Aeon Sophia to be the participant and the setting of this experiment, as well as the designer, she had to plunge into the illusion of linear time with us, my friends, and that is the other aspect of her stupor. And perhaps some clue to that is given by Apuleius when Aphrodite makes her challenge, when she proposes the task, the fourth task to Psyche. And she says, Aphrodite begs of thee to send her a small portion of thy beauty, Persephone, such at least as may suffice for the space of a brief day. That's an interesting little qualification, isn't it? That is to say that the portion of beauty that Aphrodite requests of Persephone is ample if it just suffices for a day. That is to say, it suffices within the illusion of linear time. Now, there are a number of other subtle clues like that, subtle illusions in the legend, and you would fertilize your imagination by reading it carefully. Read the Robert Graves translation of The Golden Ass. It's a delightful summer read. But in concluding the last 10-15 minutes of this briefing, I want to go really to the esoteric core of this legend into something utterly wonderful. Now, I don't know how Apuleius could have known this. All I can assume is that he was a brilliant intellectual and a brilliant novelist, which he was, and that the Teleste cultivated such people. Bear that in mind. The Teleste, the teachers of the mysteries, fostered literacy. They fostered intellectuality. They taught dialectic and argument and the trivium and so forth. They were the proponents of human intelligence. I mean, what can you say? You know? They were nothing if not the proponents of human intelligence and those who fostered the intellectual powers of the human animal to its highest degree. And so it's not inconceivable to me that they could have found in Apuleius a prize, a neophyte, as it were, and that he could have been invited to certain intramural conversations in which he picked up what I am going to tell you now. Along with recent NAV briefings, I posted my reading of the revised version of the myth of Orpheus and Eurydice. Now, I did that in preparation for the briefing that I'm recording right now. I wanted to point out that episode in which a mortal, namely Orpheus, was allowed into the realm of the dead, the realm of Hades, and allowed to return to the land of the living. And I wanted to give you that example, show you that example, to put it alongside of the example of Psyche. Because you know, in the legend, as Apuleius tells it, Psyche is a mortal girl. She becomes immortal in the happy ending of the legend, you know, when in order to marry Eros and to have a child together, which is called Hedone, or pleasure, she has to drink ambrosia and become mortal, become immortal like the gods who live on ambrosia. Oh, so that's the happy ending of the legend. But as far as the structure, the narrative structure goes, you can place Psyche as a mortal girl alongside the shaman Orpheus among the very small company of people who have been able to enter the underworld of Hades and return alive. I don't know any other examples. You know, the Greek legend or Greek language folklore, as it's more properly called, because it doesn't derive from the Greeks, it's merely transmitted through them. Greek language folklore reports the accounts of heroes like Heracles who reside in the underworld and are able to speak to the dead and counsel the dead. And you might cite the example of Aeneas and his descent into the underworld. Of course, that is one of the great, great themes of comparative mythology. It is the theme of the entire 16-volume collection of The Golden Bough of Sir James Frazer. So let's say we'll put Aeneas in the special club, okay? Aeneas, the Trojan hero, son of Anchises and Aphrodite. Funny how she comes into the picture again. Orpheus, the shaman who went to retrieve the shade of his woman Eurydice. And Psyche. As far as I know, these are the three examples from classical lore of mortals who have entered the realm of the underworld and returned alive. That itself is quite remarkable. And bear in mind what happens in the revised tale of Orpheus and Eurydice. This revision reveals an initiatory secret. As far as I know, the name Persephone has been interpreted, because you don't have to be, you don't even have to read Greek to know what it means. Just go look it up. The first part, per se, comes from the word meaning the destroyer, and the second part, phone, means voice. In fact, the Greek word for voice is phone, consisting of four letters, phi, omega, nu, and eta, phone. So telephone is a long-distance voice device. So Persephone means she who destroys the voice. But as far as I know, it's only the revised version of the myth that explains why she would destroy the voice. So I thought it was appropriate to post that myth. And now I would add the punchline, which may already have crossed your mind. She who destroys the voice can also restore the voice, can't she? That is exactly what she did for Eurydice, wasn't it? And when Persephone sent the voice of Eurydice, which had been sucked down that narrow passageway by the wind and carried back to the depths of Hades, when Persephone blew it back up the passageway, it not only shattered the shade, but it reconstituted the woman. Does that make you think of something? Does that make you perhaps think of reincarnation? What is reincarnation? On Sophia's terms, that is the beauty of Persephone. And that is the answer encoded in this legend, part of the answer to our essential and abiding question. What is the central riddle of correction? I would be proud of any one of you who can say it in your own words, like I'm going to say it now. The central riddle of correction is how Sophia's correction of this experiment proceeds differently than it would have proceeded were she not captured in the experiment. That is a central riddle of correction. And this legend and the Gnostic intel encoded into this legend provides a tremendous clue to that riddle. Persephone is she who destroys the voice, and it is a very great fact, along with the $59.95 price of your meal at Pizza Hut, that I'm the only person who has explained why she has that name. No other mythologist has ever explained it. But if she is indeed called Persephone because she destroys the voice, then she equally has the power to restore the voice. And the voice is what brings you back to life. The voice, in quotes, voice, is the generative device of reincarnation. You know, the word voice in Greek is phone, F-O-N-I, but the word sound is ekos, which is very close to echos, which is reminds you that pan and echo play a certain role also in this narrative, don't they? It seems to be a little incidental episode, but it's by no means an incidental episode that Apuleius occluded an encounter between Psyche and Pan and his nymph, his beloved nymph, Echo. Because echo is very close to ekos, which is the Greek word for sound. So what is it exactly that the Aeons of Fire can do. Caught in the stupor induced by the illusion of linear time, which is unknowable to an Aeon. Truly an underworld experience for an Aeon. And isolated in her autism, which comes from the initial conditions of the experiment, due to her dreaming it unilaterally without a consort. What can she do in these conditions that she could not have done to correct the experiment had she been able to proceed avatarically, had she been able to come from the Pleroma into the three-body system where the Anthropos lives and act upon it in that manner as she herself originally intended? What can she do in the conditions of her stupor and autism and capture to linear time that she could not do without those conditions? Well, that is the beauty of Persephone. It is the power and capacity to restore the voice, that is to say, to direct the patterns of human reincarnation to her own purposes. To give the voice, to restore the voice. You see, when someone reincarnates, what actually reincarnates is not the identity of that person, certainly not their ego. It's not even their immortal soul. It's not even some kind of oversoul. What incarnates is the same as what reincarnates. There's your proof. I'm your living proof, as you are living proof to me. But right now, you take me as a living proof. What is the proof that John Lash is incarnated? It's the voice and style and manner of his expression. And that likewise is the proof of my reincarnation. That is voice. Voice is a metaphor for the tonality, style, and intention of expression developed by a particular human animal who realizes the gift of the Anthropos, who realizes the gifts, the endowment. And that tone, style, and delivery is deathless. That is what reincarnates. The voice. And that power of Persephone to restore the voice is her beauty, and that is Sophia's beauty. That is Sophia's own beauty that she would not have were she not immersed in the experiment as she never intended to be. And so the subject of reincarnation is our topic, our intramural topic and theme during this stall. And you can see why now, can't you? You can see why. What I incarnate is the proof of what I reincarnate. Do you see that? What you incarnate is the proof of what you reincarnate. This is the only proof you'll ever get. And it's the only proof you need. And she uses this proof. She supports it. And it is a beauty in her own mind to weave the destiny of the Anthropos from the lives who reappear in an expression of humanity that can only thrive. It can only thrive. That is her beauty of her weaving of our lives. The beauty of Persephone is Sophia's handling of your expression as a human animal and taking it forward in time beyond your mortal life and giving it to another human animal. Just try to imagine that. That gifting, which is loosely and recklessly called reincarnation, is the beauty of Persephone and the special power and gift of our planetary mother in the conditions of her material imminence.